We are now recording on May 24th, 1989. The next voice you hear will be that of Milo Daly from Teton Valley. Okay, it's all set to go, and you just speak into that right there. That's the condenser mic right there.
It's on now.
It's on now. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, this is Milo Daly, and some of my relatives have asked me to a few stories about different things. One thing that we're talking about a few moments back was some of my pets that I've had. And we were talking at that time when I had a pet porcupine. One time I was out in the woods there, and it was quite common for people, I think even with the rangers in the forest, would kill the porcupine because they thought they were killing the trees and this sort of thing. And there are very few porcupines left around the area now, but I ran on to where a female porcupine had been shot, had been killed there, and I examined it. I looked at her, and I noticed that she that had the nipples, and that she was a female that probably had young and had milk. And so I searched around the area where the female porcupine was, and I found underneath a dead willow bush there. Underneath it was bent down over through the because of the snow and this sort of thing. And so underneath there was this one little porcupine. As far as I know from studying on this type of animals, a female porcupine would only have either one or possibly two young at a time. But it had there was one little one there. It was real small there. It was only at that time maybe 4 or 5 inches high on at that time, and it was underneath there. And I got it from underneath that. It had even at that time when it was small, it had quills. So I had to be careful by handling underneath it, because they don't have quills underneath it. It was on top and around the tail. But I carried it home at that time, and within a very short time, it was hungry, and of course I got some milk and got it warm, and started to feed the little porcupine. And within a few minutes, it got to where I could take a teaspoon, and would dish up the milk with it, and the little porcupine would hold up with its front claws, would hold on to the outsides of the spoon, and then would hold it up and feed himself with the milk from the spoon, and pour it into his own mouth there. I'd just pour it in the spoon and hand it to him, and he would hold it with his claws and feed it to himself. And it didn't take very long until he learned this sort of thing, and a lot of other things that it learned very rapidly. And of course I named it Porcupine, which is Porky, which is natural, I guess, what you'd give for a name there. And so I started calling it Porky, and when I'd call it, why, it would make all kinds of noises. It could grunt and talk and whine and all sort of thing, and it would, when I'd call it, it would follow me and in just a short time it would get to where it wanted to climb up my leg and clear up onto my shoulder, and then would nuzzle on my face with its on his nose and mouth. And a lot of people would wonder, well, how I could have one climb in that way without getting quills. But it was very careful about this sort of thing, and it kept the quills turned down away from toward its mouth, and when it would or head, and it would climb up very carefully, and it would climb up onto my shoulder. Ten o'clock. And so I never had any trouble with quills at all. And the porcupine, we were using wood for fuel, and we had a box for wood, and that's the place it wanted to go in to sleep there in the wood box. And it liked various kinds of things of course leafy plants of that kind, liked lettuce and cabbage and all sort of things. And it grew very fast, quite rapidly. And even though it was getting quite large, it would still climb up onto my shoulder. And it would, like I say, it would follow me around. And when I'd call me, he wanted to follow me around where I went. He was wasn't very, very fast in the way he was traveling, but he liked to go with me. It was a male porcupine. This brings other things to me, my mind. Last thing that I, with the work that I done in college, was in Logan there, of course, a place there I got my degree up in there, and my master there. And the last kind of work that I did there, mainly because I was interested about learning about things about the area, and about the world and the forests and the birds and the animals, all this kind of thing. Somebody'd have to tell what they call them now. I can't tell you very well what the environmentalists. Yeah, I wanted to learn about the environmentalist business a little bit more, and so I got I went to the university there for that. And it was that type of work that I was doing. We'd go in early in the morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, and then work for an hour in the morning, and then we'd go out into the woods and the fields and work with this sort of thing. And I remember one time in the class early in the morning, they were curious about all of these things. These were young people there, all of them. I was the only one that was older there, old person there, and that deal. All the rest of them were young people, two young professors, and then the young people there were mostly girls, the young girls that were going there at that time. And they'd ask me all the questions and other things like that, that not only for me but from others. But they'd come up, and we ran into a porcupine there, and so it brought a lot of questions about early in the morning on 7 o'clock, about questions about porcupine. And so then the professors themselves and the people in the class ask a lot of things about porcupines that I knew quite a lot, because I told them at that time that I had a pet and raised one there, and so they wondered about breeding with the porcupines, how in the world they could do that with the quills and other thing. And I said, well, yes, I can tell you about that. And well, they tell me about it, how that they can breed on that. And I said, very carefully, I told them. Of course, they laughed about that, but I took care of that. But I had this porcupine for probably 3 years after that, and it got quite large. It would, at that time, it probably is heavy and quite fat, that it was probably over 30 pounds at that time, and it still climbed up my side, up onto my shoulder, and still wanted to nuzzle his mouth and nose on my face there and talk to me, and there's a noise that he would make. But we had raspberry bushes down below the hill there at that time, and this porcupine found out that he enjoyed those new shoots in the raspberry bushes there, and he'd began to clip those off and eat the tops and the leaves off the raspberry. So we couldn't put up with that too well, so I took him back into the woods, and of course there was everything that it could live and get by and everything without any problem there on that. So I took him way back in the woods there and left him there. And another sequel onto that is that I went back with back in the country in the area in the woods there with some of the other men there that were quite often everybody carried rifles, and they liked to shoot different things, and a lot of them liked to kill. Like I say, they killed porcupine and other things like that, and it seemed to think that everything that they ought to be able to get rid of these porcupines, because the animals, the cows, if they would run back in the woods, would get quills from them, and the horses and this sort of thing. And sometimes they did, of course. And the sheep also got quills on their faces, because the reason they would because they were curious about them, and come up and put their nose in front of them to where the porcupine would flip their tails, where they'd hit them with quills, and they'd get them in their face. Now, another thing brings a nod about that. Some people thought that they would throw quills, but they don't do that at all. They have to hit something with their tails or whatever they'd flip it. But anyway, we're out in the woods with these three or four different men at that time with rifles, and so they saw a big porcupine up in the branch of a tree there, and so they began to raise their guns. We're going to shoot this porcupine. I said, no, don't do that. It might be my pet. And I said, don't shoot him. I don't know. And so I called there at that time. I said, come porky. And here this big porcupine began to grunt and mumble and talk, and he backed down off. They would be the front up and down, and would crawl downward with his feet, with his low feet down. He'd crawled on down over the hill, over the tree, and when grunting and whining and calling, and he came right up to me and climbed up right up onto to my shoulder. After it had been over a year and a half after that he came up there and came up and climbed up on my shoulder with it. So that was about that time. That was that story pretty well covered that on the Porcupine. Well, this is Milo Daly again. Now, and this is May the 24th, is it? 1989. Someone suggested that Gwen did that I should tell about one of my horses, one of my mares that I had. Of course, I could tell others about it, different horses that I had. And I found out that with horses were many other kinds of animals, that horses, if you taught them the way that you would with a dog or a cat or something of that nature, that quite often they would be friendly toward a person that way with a horse. Now, a lot of people think that that you have to use a whip or a club or something like that to teach a horse how to learn or what they have to do. But I found out that in handling with being careful and being friendly to them, they learned that way too, the way to do it. And so I had one gray mare that I had that I used quite a few years back there, and she was that way. She was friendly to me, and like a pet, really. And at one time, I was a kid there at that time working for Charlie Christensen. I'd work in the ranch quite a lot there, weeding and watering on rows and this sort of thing. But at this time, he'd been up in the mountains back in the Darby Canyon, where his sheep were ranged back in Darby Canyon, way back in the top. And so he'd come back down here, and it was late in the afternoon when he got here at home. But he wanted me to go back up on the mountain back there and Byron Christensen was the same age as I am, and we were kids at that time. I don't know, maybe 14 years old at that time. But Charlie asked me to go up in the mountain with him, and where Byron was there, and to work with the sheep at that time until he was ready to come back in here. And I don't know how many days it's going to be. It was probably a week before he figured on being back up in the canyon. And so I got my gray mare that I am talking about, and headed back up to the canyon. And I didn't know, only that he told where it would be and somewhere and how to find it. But I hadn't ever been up in there. I'd never been up in there like that time. And so he just went up to try to find where it would be up there, the sheep were. And it was late in the afternoon at that time when I started that way up toward the mountain. And of course, it got late evening, and of course it was beginning to get clouds and everything, and got late that evening, and then it finally got black when I was dark and when I was back in the mountain. And I had quite a lot of experience at that time. It was I think that in all my life I'd have a lot of experience about being trouble and fear, but the worst that I had ever, that I found at that time, was that fear that I realized at that time. And the reason about that, I'd have to explain about it. I headed back over the, back up in the mountain there, and of course it got black, dark, because it was clouded, and then it started to rain on top of that. I couldn't see a thing, I didn't have a light of any kind, and I had a rifle. That was quite a usual thing, was to have a rifle. So I had a rifle all right, but it got down to where I couldn't ride the mare very well to see anything about where I was going, or the trees, the limbs, and that I might hit and everything. So I climbed off the mare, and Babe, I called her, was Babe. And so I was leading her along and trying to find on the mountain side there. It was on the steep mountain there, and just finding our way the best we could. And we'd run into rock, and all that time it was hard to find our way. But we got way back in there, and I finally got to where I could hear the sheep blatting back in there, but it was way back up in there, and I was quite a ways away at that time. But I moved along there, and then I could be, all of a sudden I could hear something whipping around in the bushes and the trees right there. And I couldn't see anything, it was dark, and my mare was afraid of it and began to pull back at me, back because of that that sound of whipping in the bushes and this sort of thing. Well, the only thing that I thought was that it some kind of a, would be a, probably a grizzly bear at that time. And so I took my rifle, I had the rifle on the saddle, and so I got that, and I thought, well, if he's going to come at me, I want to be close enough where I could make a good shot on it. And so I tied my mare to a tree there, and then I took my rifle toward the movement in the bushes. And when I'd move forward, then the thrashing would go on there in the bushes, and I just figured sure it was probably a grizzly bear. And so I thought to myself, instead of running away, I made my mind go ahead on it, where I could get close enough if I had to, if it came at me. I wanted to be a good shot close there, where I could make a good shot there. And so I got closer and closer, and the thrashing went on there about, and I was afraid, because I sure that whatever it was going to come on to pounce to me there on me. And I finally got right up to, as dark as it was, I could see that there was some movement that was thrashing around in the right there in the bushes and right there. And so I got right up to it with my, it's a wonder, a great wonder that I didn't shoot that the animal that was there. It was a wonder that I didn't shoot it with, I had several bullets in it, and it's a wonder that I didn't shoot everything that I had into it, because it was thrashing and kicking and making a big fuss there. But instead of that, I moved right up to closer and closer all the time, and finally I realized what it was, that the pack horse that they had, that they usually had in the, always did when they were back in the woods with the sheep, it had was staked out with a rope, and it had got tangled up in there with the ropes wrapped around its feet, and it had thrown itself down. It where it couldn't get up. And it was fighting its feet, trying to get up on its feet again, and it couldn't because the ropes were pulled tight and then wrapped around his feet in the back and doubled up underneath there till he couldn't even move, and he was just trying to get back on his feet. And so then I realized what it was, but I say it was a big miracle that I hadn't shot it there, because I thought about it quite a lot at the time. But anyway, I realized that when I was, I must be close around there where Byron was. And so I began to call and yell, and all I could hear was the baa sounds of the sheep. But finally I did, way back in there, and it was raining at that time. I could hear it was raining, and even the lightning was striking quite often there. And finally I heard a sound from Byron Christensen way back in there. And so I followed there the sound, both of us, and we finally came together. And when I got back in there, Byron couldn't find where the camp was. Of course, we had a one kind of camp where we could food in there, and the other was a teepee where we had a bed in there where we'd small teepee where we'd have a bed in there and sleep in there away from the rain. But he had forgotten, couldn't find his way because dark and everything. He couldn't even find his way to where the camp was. But when I got there and knew where this horse was staked, then I could find, with him, we could find where the teepee. Of course, we didn't have the teepee set up, because it had just been had been oated there and was laying there, and then it rained on there, and it was soaked all the way through with the teepee and the bed that we had in there, and everything was soaked wet. But we found the place there, and we in the dark we set up the teepee, but then we couldn't sleep in this bed because it was just sopping wet. So we just built a fire there where set for that to keep warm. And we were wet too and cold. But then about day after that, we also had we had the pack horse there, and then we had also a couple of riding horses there that we had there, and so we had this my mare, this Babe that I had, and so anyway, the others we turned them loose with hobbles on their front feet. And of course they could jump and move around with the hobbles on their feet. And but I had learned that my mare, that she would stay, as far as I knew, she would stay with a camp with me. And but anyway, a few afternoon or evenings after that we'd been here, then the horses, we found out that there was the hobbles, they'd headed down the road to get back to their ranch in Pratt Ward, in Charlie Christensen's ranch there. And they were gone, they'd gone down the mountain. And my mare was gone too. And we were left alone, just the two there, and didn't have a horse or anything like that. And we were just on foot. Anyway, in the middle of the night, I could, all at once, I could hear my mare calling, whinnying back in the trail coming back up the mountain. And it became closer on there, and it was still whinnying. And it came, finally it came right up to where we were and came right up to me all by herself, left the other horses and everything, and came up alone, clear up to, right up to me, right up into the place, clear back in the head of the canyon there. Came back up to find where I was to be with me, which is unusual, I think, for most anybody would think that they wouldn't believe that this is true about a horse. I have had many other times I've had horses with this thing, stories about them. I bought a thoroughbred mare that I bought from a man that had thoroughbred racing horses there in Rexburg. And I bought this one, and this is at the time in the Second War. And so I had a job working in Driggs with the agricultural business back here, back in Driggs. And so I was riding this mare back and forth instead of not using a car at that time. I was riding back and forth, going early in the morning, I'd head down and then ride back up after the job done. But this mare, I don't know how she had been treated or anything of that nature back in Rexburg to this man that was in the racing business. But when I got her back, when I bought her, I treated like she was a real pet there. And one thing or another, I bought her a new deal there on it that she could wear. And when it was cold, a blanket. I had a yellow blanket trimmed with red and everything, that when it was cold I'd put the blanket on her and fix her up that, and I fed her all the time. I gave her good hay, and then in between times in the morning and at noon I'd give her, and at night I'd give her oats. Of course she loved that. And I'd ride her down to Driggs in the morning, and she loved to ride for me to ride her. And I turned her loose by herself. I'd leave her in the pasture, and in the morning to get her, I'd never even have to take a rope or anything. I just call to her and take the bridle, and when she'd see coming, she'd raise her tail up and her head high, right up high and stick up there, and then she would run just as hard as she could run to the up to the front end of the pasture, and then she'd whirl and run clear to the bottom and just run as hard as she could run. She enjoyed to run, and with her tail up and her head up, and just tearing as hard as she could run. And I'd just wait, never have to say a thing, and then after three or four runs across the pasture, she'd whirl and run right up to me, and right up to me and stop right there. And so I'd just have to go and put the bridle on and take her in, and then I'd give her some oats and put the saddle and get her ready to head down to Driggs. And she enjoyed, I'd have to hold her down because she wanted to play on the way. She'd never buck to throw me out, but she wanted to play and buck and play with all the way. And she'd, if I'd let her go, she'd want to go on a run all the way if I'd let her. I don't know how far she'd be where she'd give out, but she wanted to run if I'd let her, but it was all in fun, and she wanted to play and jump and kick and just have fun. And then I had a barn where I put her in the daytime, and I put some hay, what I'd put there and there ahead of time. I'd carried some hay in there, and I had oats there where keep for her, and I put some hay for her, but I'd take the saddle off and the bridle, and I'd tie her up there in the barn. But when I went to leave, she'd be extremely angry when I'd leave, because she didn't want me to leave, because she'd tromp her feet to their front feet. She'd just tromp and snort and carry on, and she'd kick with her hind feet. She wouldn't kick at me at all. She'd never kicked me in the world, but she'd tromp with her front feet and then kick and tromp with her hind feet. She was angry because I'd leave her there. And then in the daytime, at noon, I'd go back, and of course I'd have lunch, I'd eat there, and then I'd go over with the mare, and I'd give her some oats, and then she'd whinny on her and carry on. She was just so happy when I came there, when I'd come and feed her. And so then the same thing at noon when I was ready to leave, why, she'd become angry, and she'd just tromp and snort and just as angry as anything could be and tromp her feet. And then the same at the night when I'd get back to head for homie, well, then she was just tickled to death and carried on and whinnied and carried on that way, and she was tickled to death. She liked me to ride her back, and all the way home, like, she wanted to run, and she just wanted to play and kick and buck, and not to throw me or anything like that, but just wanted to frisk like a lamb would jump and carry on. But I had her for several years, and at that time, a lot of the people at that time were having racing on racing with horses on cutters and this sort of thing in the winter, and so I had people come that were trying to buy this mare. They wanted to put it with another with a horse or mare that would that maybe match with her, that they could run fast with. And I didn't want to sell her, but there was one fellow kept after me, and so I thought, well, I'll get rid of her, get rid of him by telling how high that I was going to charge if I was going to sell this mare. And I thought, well, I'll put the cost up there till he won't have anything to say about it, because I never had the idea that he would buy it. And so I gave her a figure on it. Now I can't remember just exactly what I said, but it was way above what that anybody would figure on paying for a mare or a horse, anything like that. And so I told her, well, I said, if you buy that, you'll have to pay so much there that you'll have to pay. And I thought it'd be so high that she would, that'd be the end of it. And instead of that, well, he said, well, I'll take it, I'll buy her. And I couldn't very well back down on it after I'd made that promise or agree on it. And so he paid, and I bought it from her. But he used that in racing until the race deal was over with. They'd race here in Driggs, and they'd race over in Jackson too. They'd take the mares over there, and they'd race over there. And anyway, when they got through with the racing, I didn't realize what they would do, but I guess it was a common thing with the other farmers, and one thing and another that they did, they'd just take them out into the winter and turn them loose at a straw stack for them to eat on there. And you see, with me, it had been entirely different than that. I'd kept a blanket on her, and I'd had her in the barn, and I'd fed her good hay, and I fed her oats all the time and everything of that nature. And then I didn't know, didn't realize what he had was going to do or what he had done, and what he got through with that. He just turned out with some other horses out there and turned them out in the winter with only with straw and with then snow for them to drink. And of course, here again, I'd carried good water and even warm it up when it was a little bit there. When it was real cold, I'd warm it up a little for the mare to drink and all that sort of thing. But she couldn't stand that, and in a little while she died out in the winter there. I felt awful bad about that because I had done it. Does that turn it off here? What do you do? I'll tell a little bit about one pet that I had. It was a magpie that I had many years back there. When I was probably around 6 and 7 and 8 years old at that time, I had a picture at that time. I have one at this time. I have when I was 7 years old, when I had a picture with me with this magpie. But I raised this when it was just getting feathered out enough to where it could start to fly a little bit. And I never clipped its feathers or anything of that nature. And I've seen stories about people who have raised birds of that nature, and one thing they told that we had to clip their tongues, and that there was no truth in this. This was wrong entirely. It was wrong to even do that, to clip their tongues. This was wrong. But you didn't have to do anything except to be friend to them and take care of them and treat them as they were good pets should be. My folks were really pretty good on that too, because I raised this magpie, and it lived just ran flew where it wanted, but it at night it slept, it roosted in the room there, and we nearly always we had an elk head that had been made up there and set up on the wall. And this magpie always roosted up on one of the antlers of this elk. And so the folks would put some newspaper just underneath the magpie so that it didn't cause any mess there at night. And it would sit on the one antler all the time. But it didn't take very long until this magpie began to learn various things in words and getting more phrases and to hold to a sentence at a time. And then it could also whistle almost anything that you could show him. That they could whistle very well and very loud and shrill, anything that you wanted to teach him. And one thing I guess that we'd have to tell a story about that was rather humorous in a way was that it was always a friendly to me, but it was bad with strangers for one thing. It would want to fight back on that, and then it would torment other people, like my dad, that tormented him quite a lot and bothered him. When he'd be working, why, it would go and stir up a fight all the time. And one thing it would like to do is would be to jump up and get my dad's, it'd get him by his ear and hang on with its beard, with its beak. And so then my dad would swear quite a lot. He knew how to swear real well, and he'd swear at this magpie, and he'd use the real words all right. He'd yell at this magpie, says, "Go away, S of a B, go away, S of a B," and only he was using the real words. And this magpie learned right away that it Earl learned all of these swearing words and could copy just the same as